Welcome to the Demimonde Podcast, an unofficial podcast covering the Showtime series Penny Dreadful. Joining us this evening, we are No Ship Network. I am your host, Em.
And I'm your host, Steve.
If you want to join our discussion, you can reach us by visiting our website at noship.net. Click anywhere it says contact and it will direct you to the various means you can use to reach us. If you would like to support us, one way is to do your Amazon shopping by clicking on our Amazon affiliate link located on our website. It does not cost you any extra money. Amazon kindly gives us a percentage of anything you purchase through them. Another way is to rate and or review us on iTunes. Currently, this is the best way to get the word out about our podcast because it directs more traffic our way. You can also share our links on your preferred social networking site. Okay, let's get to it. We are discussing Penny Dreadful, Season 1, Episode 1, Nightwork. The creator is John Logan. Director, Juan Antonio Bayona. The executive producers are John Logan, Sam Mendes, and Pippa Harris. And the composer is Abel Korzeniowski. Hope I said that correctly.
Hard name to pronounce, but does a really good job.
Yes. So do you want to discuss any thoughts you've had on this episode? Or actually, I think we should introduce ourselves first.
Okay.
And then we can talk about how we thought about this episode. So I'm Em. I do podcasts on Vikings, and I've done one on Spartacus. And we decided to go ahead and do Penny Dreadful because we watched the first episode and thought it was awesome. I don't really have a huge horror background. No, I have read The Portrait of Dorian Gray. I'm familiar with the Frankenstein story. I read Bram Stoker's Dracula. But I do like things set in the Victorian era, so that's what attracts me the most to this. And Steve, I know you're a horror fan.
Yes, I am. I'm a big horror buff. I watch a lot of horror. I read a lot of horror. And you might recognize my voice from the other podcasts that I've done with Em and Paul. We're doing this one together. Just the two of us, and have no fear, Paul will be back for next season of Vikings. But
and maybe something else.
Yeah, sure, and maybe something else in the meantime. But we were kicking around different ideas for different shows to do, and this is what we landed on because this is what really reached out and grabbed us. You know, this is there might be, like we said, there might be another show coming up that we could do. I don't want to throw anything out there and not follow up on it, so I'll just kind of say there's another show we're looking at. But this is the show that really did it for me. Being a horror fan, this hit all the right marks, and it did it well. It wasn't, half-assed. It wasn't trying to be funny. It wasn't trying to be something that it's not. I felt like it was, it's a period piece, and if you've listened to us podcast before, you know that we do period pieces. This is the third historical show that
we've
done.
Not on purpose.
Yeah, it's not on purpose.
It turns out that way.
Yeah, it just turns out that the best shows that are being made lately are, not contemporary, at least to our taste. And I felt that this was it's good escapism, number one, which I really like in my horror, because you can have different kinds of horror. You can have the kind that's making a metaphor for something else, and then you can have the kind that just plays it straight on, and that's what this is. There's no there's not an underlying comedy to it. There's no snarkiness to it. It's mm-hmm. played straight on the nose, and it benefits from that because everything's taken seriously and the audience is expected to take it seriously, and you're rewarded for that. And I really, really like that kind of horror. That's the kind of horror that always scared me the most. Other kinds of horror is fun when they have, when there's comedy involved and there's, let's say, like a Return of the Living Dead, for example, is a great example of a movie that actually had a lot of comedy and horror mixed in. And there's a ton of other examples. I'm just pulling that one out of my hat. But this plays it straight, and I really appreciated it because too much horror that's been portrayed on TV, at least in recent years, has kind of fallen short of the mark for me because I'm a big critic because I love the genre so much. But I think part of the reason why it's failed is because they try to add in these elements that just aren't there. And this show is just giving it to you straight.
So as far as our background with the show, we've only watched the first episode. We're not going to spoil anything beyond. We're going to watch each episode, then podcast on it. So
Yeah,
we're
this is the perfect accompaniment to somebody who's just watching the show as well.
yeah.
Just
So
like
there's
we
no
are.
chance for spoilers
Yes.
because we don't know what happened. So
We'll
we're
speculate a little bit, but there's not going to be any spoilers because we're going to try our hardest not to be spoiled ourselves and, see what's coming up.
Okay, so any thoughts on this particular episode before we get started?
It's a great episode. I've seen it now 3 times and it gets actually better each time I watch it. 'Cause usually when I watch multiple times of an episode of a TV show, I start to see the flaws and I start to see where things start to drag a little bit. Even if I still think it's good overall, I start to see that little bit of like, okay, we can kind of fast forward to this part if we don't, if we can. But not so with this one. It got better each time. I saw a little bit more each time. So that is definitely a good thing for me because I feel like there has to be that kind of meat on the bone for a show for me to want a podcast on it, and it's there.
Yeah, I agree. It got better every time I watched it, which I watched it a lot.
Yeah. Well, you've seen it like what, 5 or 6 times
I
now?
don't know. I don't know. So we're gonna go ahead and get right into the recap. So the episode opens with a mother and child being murdered by some supernatural force. It sets the stage well, I think. Seeing the impoverished setting of these characters' living arrangement lets us know we are viewing a story set in the time of Dickens. We are also told that humans are helpless prey in this story.
So have you zeroed in on a year, do you think? Or like roundabout, maybe?
Well, Jack the Ripper, I think, finished his reign in like 1891, and the newspapers were saying Jack the Ripper's back.
Okay.
So, let me double check that on this timeline I have here. This little handy.
Handy dandy.
Okay, yeah, so it is. So, 1888, first of a series of up to 11 murders committed by Jack the Ripper in the East End of London. Crimes continued until 1891, and a number of suggestions have put forward as to the identity of the Ripper. So anyway, so it could be sometime after 1891.
Okay.
Did you want to make any other points about the opening
I
scene?
felt bad for that little girl because, her mom gets out of bed to go use the privy, and then, she hears that loud noise, and then she's like, "Mom, Mom, where you at?" And then she gets out of bed, and you can see she's only wearing one sock, so you kind of get this feeling of the impoverished state of the common person in this area or this
Definitely.
era, rather, of England. And she walks down the hall and sees what she sees and just lets out this blood-curdling scream. And it's a good opening for a show.
And it leads us right into the opening credits. And is there anything you wanted to say about the opening credits?
I'm not arachnophobic, but that spider is pretty creepy. I mean, I'm pretty
Yeah.
sure it's magnified however many times to be made to look that big, but I mean, that looked like a big gnarly spider. If I saw that crawling on me when I woke up, I would freak out.
It's pretty, but yeah, I would freak out too.
Yeah.
Not, it's pretty from a distance. The opening credits have a werewolf or a wolf-like creature, so it's I haven't seen any since I've seen this episode 5 or 6 times, it's been on my mind. So I'm thinking, and I don't think it's spoiler for me to say this because I don't know if it's true.
So it's speculation then.
It's speculation, but I think Ethan Chandler is a werewolf, and I'll point out why
Okay. All
as we
right.
move along.
Can try to convince me. We'll
Yeah,
see.
because you don't think so, because I've pointed this out to you and you don't
It's
really.
not so much that I don't think so. There's just one or two little things that I'll point out where I feel like if he was, he might have a different reaction to something that's
Yeah.
going on. So, and I'll just point that out
Okay.
and just see if it provides a counterbalance. And it could be that it's a little bit weak. My part of it's weak.
Well, we'll see. Okay, so the next scene introduces us to Vanessa Ives, although we haven't actually learned her name yet. She is played by the striking and captivating Eva Green. This scene is fantastic, I think. It kept me riveted seeing her praying fervently in a sparsely decorated room, and it was only adorned with that cross on the wall. So, what's going on here with this character, do you think?
She's praying like, well, first they show a shot from behind and it looks like it's a decapitated person. You don't see a head,
Yeah.
and she, you see
Creepy.
her knuckles and she's all together and she's just praying really. I'm not sure what language she's using. I think it's
I think
probably Latin.
sounds like Latin.
Yeah. I mean, people tend to pray like that in Latin. So, I mean, not stereotyping, but I'm just saying, that's, if you were praying that fervently in a language that wasn't English, it would probably be Latin. And, when she looks up at the cross and she's praying like that, and then there's this moment where she kind of stops, and it almost looks like she's letting something in, or she's giving free rein to something that's already there. I don't know, but it's kind of cool because the way they film this scene, it's like she's praying and then she kind of sits up a little bit more upright and she's like baring her soul. And at the same time, the back of her dress goes up and you can see the actual soles of her feet too. So it kind of
Yeah.
like, I don't know if you're supposed to,
That's interesting.
if there is something there or what.
Well, do you think the spider is somehow related? Because the spider scuttles out from behind the cross, and then it's I get the impression that the same spider, went down, crawled up her dress, and then onto her arm, and that's when she started to kind of have this thing take over her in a
But
way.
it's almost like the spider was in one spot and then in another. It was like almost automatically. It didn't, we didn't see it scuttle anywhere. She's looking at it right by the cross. Then a second later, it's, and she's about a good 5 or 6 feet away from the wall, and then the next thing you know, you see it on her arm. So there could be, there very well could be a supernatural element to that, the spider being a representation of
I think you
something.
actually see it go down the wall.
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
Well, I saw it start heading down the wall, but you
Right.
don't see it
And
traverse the floor
then
and
you see
then.
it kind of go up like
Yeah.
the her upper arm and then up her lower arm and
We'll
then to
just
her
say it's a
hand.
quick spider.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well,
But
yeah, it's definitely
it's
quick.
definitely supposed to be the same one. I don't know if this is like a representation of some malign force, but once it gets on her, that's when she gets to be different. So,
It seems malign because you hear that voice.
yeah.
And then you hear a growl, and I don't know what that voice is saying.
No, I know. As many times as I've watched it, I can't tell.
Bothers me. I can't figure it out. Okay, so hopefully there'll be answers later. If a listener has figured it out.
Yeah, but don't spoil us with anything. If you can give us
If it's
the,
not spoilery,
yeah.
let us know. So, okay, I think we covered that. So next we are introduced to an Ethan Chandler, played by Josh Hartnett. We learn he is an American, an actor, and a bit of a rake. Highlights of his introduction scene are when he first notices Vanessa Ives and his awesome aim both on the field and in the sack, so to speak.
Or up against the wall.
Yeah, that's why I said so to speak.
The scene where he notices Ives is cool because I think it's a nod towards the movie Phantasm when the tall man sees the boy and everybody else is looking in one direction, but that character is looking at the screen, which is supposed to be the point of view of the character, which we would have the point of view of Ethan Chandler in this,
Right.
So I don't know. I might be reaching here because of my horror movie nerdism or whatever, but I think it's a nod to Phantasm.
I just know that it gave a level of creepiness that you want, in a show like this, but it also made me go, yes, I definitely want a podcast on this show because if they're, doing that much attention to detail, I can only imagine what else they're going to do down the road. So I really like that touch. It's a great introduction to her, of her to him, I think. Probably made his werewolf hair stand on the back of his neck.
I like the way she smiles. She kind of has that like half smile smirk whenever he fires that last shot, because he's just horn dogging it. You know what I mean? And she's just like, okay, we'll go talk to this guy. He's full of crap. Or we'll see if he's full of crap.
Yeah, so he ends up sleeping with that lady that you're referring to, where he sh did the last shot
Yeah.
into her hat or what, the feather on her hat. And yeah, so first clue, he's a werewolf, doggy style. I know it's weak, but it's a start. You'll see.
Okay, as long as it's the first of many clues, I'll go with it. But if that's
yeah.
all you got, then we.
So, and then I was talking about his aim because he was like, doing her doggy style, then he flips her around and it's like, didn't have to reposition, he could have bent his penis and, but I don't think it's possible to do that.
Is that, I mean, are you putting forth the like supposition that that's a werewolf thing? Because to me,
No, I'm
that.
just pointing out that I had mentioned that he has awesome aim both on the field and in the sack, and I'm just corroborating that statement I made earlier.
Okay, I can go with you a little bit on that, but part of me wants to throw down the TV sex card, which is TV sex is always unrealistic, and this is just yet another example. Even in a show of this caliber that's doing really great on so many other levels, that sex was really TV.
I think he just has awesome aim.
Oh, or it could be that. Yeah, we'll go with that.
So after Ethan's introduction, we have a scene where he and Vanessa Ives meet and they have a little chat. So we initially see that Ethan may have a conflicted re relationship with his father. And this is my next werewolf clue. Don't werewolves usually have conflicted relationships with their father? Isn't it usually passed down from the father? It seems to be in the lore I've experienced. So
Yeah, if you look at Teen Wolf, Michael J. Fox, remember his dad was standing outside the bathroom. He's like, "Son, I know what you're going through."
Yeah, exactly. There you go.
There we go. That's all we need. Put the Hammer horror films aside for a second. We'll just go with Teen Wolf. We're good.
Thanks for supporting me. So Miss Ives, she assesses him in a Sherlockian, calculating way. She surmises that he is a much more complex man than he likes to appear. There's another werewolf clue there. And the statement seems to disturb him when she says that. And she's very tight-lipped regarding the nature of the job. She returns his questions about the criminality and murder with, "Would it matter?" And he tells her he wants a smile if he is to agree to do the job. And she barely gives him one. And then she leaves him with an address card and tells him to find a policeman if he needs aid. And as she's leaving, he asks if she has a name, and she just says yes.
I thought this was interesting because he went so far as to have sex with one of the ladies who appreciated his show and his aim. And in that scene, we didn't really talk about it, but she asks, "Don't you want to know my name?" And he doesn't say anything. He doesn't say yes or no or anything. He just kind of goes, yeah, good point, you know. But he wants to know her name, and all they've done is share 2 minutes of conversation.
I think Miss Vanessa Ives probably saw him banging her because she's like, "Great finale."
Then she's like, "I'm looking for some night work," and he says, "Aren't we all?"
Yeah.
So there's a little bit of like a sexual innuendo going on between them, but she handles it well and doesn't like, there's no, like I said before, this show plays it straight. So there's no over the top goofiness in these, conversations between people, which I really appreciate.
So later that night, they meet in an alleyway. He is on time because he does not like to keep a lady waiting. She said that is very wise of him. They duck into an opium den. I'm pretty sure that's what it is.
That's what it looks like. I mean, they have the stereotypical Chinese people there, and, you know, they're letting people in. I don't know if she had some sort of special knock or if they recognized her or if because she's friends with the character we're about to meet, she was let in because of that. But it's definitely an opium den because I've been to a few. No, I'm just kidding. that's what it looked like, you know, all the times that I've read about them in, you know, Lovecraft or this or that. That's somewhat what I imagined. I probably imagined it a little bit cleaner.
Really?
But yeah, I guess if you're using the word den, you're not really, you know, having connotations towards sanitation and cleanliness.
Got laconic people around. Yeah. And
they're going to be lazy. They're not going to pick up after themselves. No. Heroin does that to you. Yeah.
So they soon meet with another, as you already mentioned, Sir Malcolm Murray. And Sir Malcolm Murray is played by Timothy Dalton. And at once, he appears to be a respectable man. He's got a nice, snazzy coat on, a hat. He's wearing a cravat, and he's got a cane. And his countenance is lucid, so he's clearly not a patron of this den.
He's really stern. You know, he's just, like, stern and straightforward.
You know, I know he was 007. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen that particular one. I'm not sure if I've seen Timothy Dalton in anything, but he's really impressed me as an actor. He's got this gravitas, like, with his voice, mm-hmm. and he seems to make acting look easy. He doesn't seem to do very much, you know what I mean? It's hard to explain, but I really like his acting style.
It was
style.
Good casting. He's good. He has that, like, older guy authority, you know what I mean? Like, if you're a guy, you look at him and you think like, "Oh, this, you know, this could be like a cool uncle." You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Who would teach me how to like do archery or something like that. You know?
But he also has like an intensity in his gaze too, which is later on. I don't know if I'll mention it then, but I think when he's meeting with Victor Frankenstein at the Explorer Club, like mm-hmm. just the conversation that took place between them, that was where I really noticed a lot of his acting. So Sir Malcolm Murray, he asks Vanessa Ives if this is the individual, and he's gesturing towards Ethan. He then asks Ethan, "Did you bring the weapons?" Ethan pulls back his duster to reveal his holstered weapon. Then Ethan asks, "Wait a minute. What are we doing here?" Mr. Murray says, "We are looking for someone. More than that is on the need to know." I like that statement. I've never heard it phrased that way. And then Mr. Murray then advises Ethan with a cryptic warning saying to not be amazed by anything he sees and do not hesitate.
But he already knows he's being hired to kill people or things or whatever.
Something nefarious.
Yeah, various and sundry nefarious things.
So they begin their way by descending down a staircase. We learn here after Ethan asks, that Sir Murray is looking for someone very dear to him. And I'll go ahead and say now that this would be his daughter, Mina, which will be Mina Murray from Bram Stoker's Dracula.
So this puts Malcolm Murray in the, I guess you could say, the Van Helsing role.
Yes.
For lack of a better term.
Yeah.
I mean, because if you have each of the horror tropes and there's a person that's connected to each one of them, if you're right and Ethan is a werewolf, you've got that. You've got Frankenstein, which we'll hear from later. You've got the vampires going on. And this guy has a daughter named Mina, even though Van Helsing didn't have a daughter. And, Mina was somebody else altogether. They're just using the familiarity of the trope to kind of tie in.
I wonder if we'll have a Renfield. Interesting. They'll bring Tom Waits. Okay. So they are walking through what appears to be an open space within a building's foundational structure. I didn't really know how else to describe that. And they meet up with what you and I have decided are thralls.
And for somebody who doesn't know, a thrall, as far as I can tell in the lore of what I read over years and years of horror movie and book consumption, a thrall is a baby vampire. Okay, maybe that's not quite accurate. It's a vampire who's been made or been bitten and hasn't quite made the transformation into being a full vampire with all the attendant powers and limitations. So they can still be killed the way you would kill a normal human being, just with a lot more difficulty, I guess you could say. And they do the bidding of their master. So that's where you get the thraldom from.
And we determined that because they were able to be killed by being shot through the head.
Exactly. Yeah. Or hooked through the mouth, which was pretty cool.
Yeah.
Kill shot for a TV show.
That was Lagertha style right there.
It was. Yeah. It was. And in the first episode.
Yeah.
Ooh. Oh, yeah.
Okay. So, and one of the thralls looks like Nosferatu. So I guess any wannabe vampire would try to look like Nosferatu.
It's almost like you have three
one
different...
looks like Lestat.
One looks like an Anne Rice vampire, yes.
With the blonde, like half-dreaded hair.
Actually, no, that's not the one the one that he talks to initially, Malcolm talks to initially, he's the one that reminds me of an Anne Rice vampire.
Really?
Because he's like a pretty boy, kind of good-looking vampire. And then you've got the Nosferatu, one that with the bald head and almost pointy ears and everything. That's an obvious reference. Out of the three, I'm sure that's the one that's on the mark. And the other one would be like a Blade vampire. I don't know if you've ever seen the Wesley Snipes
series of
movies.
Yeah, I've
seen the first one. And they had I'm just pulling it out of my hat here, but there's a couple of dreadlocked vampires in there.
Oh, okay.
So. But
I was thinking it could have been Lestat during his rock and roll years, but I don't know if he had dreads or not.
Not the biggest Lestat fan, I couldn't tell you.
Yeah.
I like Anne Rice, but I just can only go so far because I hold her personally responsible for Twilight, and I'm not going to ever forgive her.
You might
have
to explain that. Somebody's going to call you out on that. Okay.
All right, we'll have a discussion.
So when the fight breaks out, Mr. Murray and Ethan are the targets, and this lets Miss Ives to walk away unencumbered when she hears a female voice. And I was wondering about this female voice because you don't ever see the source of it. And do you think it's like something only she can hear? Or do you think it's something the vampire nest employs to lure victims into the place?
Either one is equally feasible. I didn't think of the first one. I thought of the second one, but I didn't think of the first one. That could be something because Ives has some sort of juju or power or something going on. And I don't know if it's a negative thing or if it's a positive thing or if it's something negative that can be harnessed for positive. So, as we'll see in a scene that's coming up in a few minutes, but I don't know. That's a coin toss on that one.
Okay. So she's following this voice down further into the depths of this building when she walks into the vampire's nest. The vampire's nest looks like to be an area containing hanging rotted rags, miscellaneous filth, and piles of skinned bodies. It's very homey.
It's disgusting is what it is. And this was done really well because... Like, I guess as you can tell already, from my comments about Anne Rice and Twilight, I'm not a huge fan of the romantic style of vampire. I like the down and dirty Brian Lumley kind of style. And this doesn't really go that far, but having a vampire underneath a pile of rotted carcasses is pretty badass.
It's pretty disgusting. And so this is going to show, like, my level of horror tolerance. Jeepers Creepers scared the shit out of me, and the bodies that were hung in his little art piece in
Mm-hmm.
that movie were skinned too, and that reminded me of that.
Yeah,
Just the look of the
you got points off for being scared by Jeepers Creepers, and I mean you've earned them back, but you definitely got points off when we watched that.
So anyway, moving on. So there are a number of platinum-haired females laying about as well. And Miss Vanessa Ives peers at one and discovers fang marks on her neck and a dead infant at her side. At this point, the lead thrall we met earlier has broken away from his buds and has come to secure the nest. Miss Ives asks him, "Where is your master?" And he says, "Closer than you think. Would you like to meet him?" And he slowly starts to walk towards her, and then he is shot from behind by Ethan, first through the back and then through the head. Luckily, none of them hit her because she was directly in front of him. So.
Yeah, I guess we're just kind of going back to the fact that he's an ace shot,
Yeah, he can
and
even account for a ricochet on the brain pan.
this type of caliber bullet's not going to make it through the skull and hit an innocent bystander.
So, Mr. Murray and Miss Ives inspect another unconscious platinum-haired female and determine it is not Mina. Meanwhile, Ethan notices some movement amidst a pile of bodies. So, this is where we meet our first master vampire. I'm thinking it's a master. Must be, because what we discover about his body
Right,
later, you
right.
know. And bullets are merely butterfly kisses to this guy, and he knocks Ethan away. Miss Ives ensnares him, this master vampire, with her gaze, and her gaze holds some unknown power, because I don't know how she did that.
You know what I took away from this is that the way he looked at her, and then he cocks his head back a little bit, and he kind of turns his head, and he's looking at her
A curiosity.
like, why are you? Why am I feeling what I'm feeling off of you? First of all, he just doesn't kill her out of hand. So there's
Right.
something that gives him pause. And whatever that is, I don't know if he sees, I'm not going to say, I don't know, maybe evil recognizing evil, perhaps. I don't know. Or some sort of power recognizing another power. And it stops him up short. And, it gives, regardless of what it is, we're going to find out. But I mean, eventually, but it gives Malcolm enough time to kind of come around and.
To be like the power of Shaitan versus what was the power that Padan Fain was under?
That was like his own thing, wasn't
No,
it?
the knife, the really,
Oh, the Shatterlogoth knife?
is it Shatterlogoth? Okay.
Yeah.
That you got two evil opposing forces. I don't know if she's evil. I don't think so.
I don't think she's evil. I think there's something in her that's dark, and I think
Yeah.
that the vampire recognized it.
So it's like a necessary tool for her to delve into whatever
That's
she's.
why she felt she could just stand in front of, Murray like that, because she knew that he wasn't going to just plow through her. Like, because if she was just a regular woman off the street, she'd be dead.
Yeah.
So.
Okay. So this allows Mr. Murray to sneak behind the vamp and stake him with his cane insert apparatus stake.
Pretty cool. Pretty
Yeah.
cool.
I wonder what it's made out of. He's an explorer of Africa. It had this bone-like
Handle.
look to it. Like the blade itself, it was white. It was a milky white.
Ivory, maybe.
Don't know.
I like that this vampire just didn't. We're following our own mythology here in this show. It's not taking off like page, word for word off of another script. It doesn't disappear into dust. It doesn't go up in flames. It doesn't scream or anything. It just dies.
Doesn't blow up into bloody blood clots everywhere,
Yeah.
which is nice.
There's already enough dead bodies in this scene. That would have been overkill.
So again, Mr. Murray and Miss Ives turn over another platinum vamp woman. Again, she is not who they are looking for. So Mr. Murray jostles her lazy ass awake. He wants to know if there is another master. And then the she vampire's responds only with the teeth gnashing and hissing. And this frightens Ethan. Mr. Murray stakes the vampire. And Mr. Murray tells Ethan that the night is not over. And Miss Ives beseeches Ethan for more of his help.
I like this scene because it lets you know if you watch it like with your mind open, it lets you know that Murray he doesn't seem to have any supernatural powers. He doesn't seem to have any edge over, the creatures of the night or anything like that, but he's not afraid.
He's well acquainted with it, is
He's
what
yeah,
it seems
exactly. He's well
like.
acquainted. He has a past with it because he just takes a what's basically a new vampire, which is going to be stronger than him, and he just takes her head and pushes it over to the side and says, "Where can I find more of those?"
Yeah.
He's not afraid at all. And I think that was pretty badass.
And extermination of platinum-haired ladies is underway. And by now we have learned that brunettes are awesome and blonde bitches suck. Ha ha.
Betty Page 1, Marilyn Monroe 0.
Did you notice I said suck?
Yeah,
All right. Okay. So now it is time for our next important character introduction. We have Victor Frankenstein, played by Harry Treadaway, and he's a saucy little nerd.
Yeah, he's kind of an asshole when they first meet him.
Yeah.
He's basically telling them just, I mean, they bring these carcasses
He's like,
down there
bugger off.
to what did Murray say? This is where men ply the resurrection trade.
I don't remember.
I think something like that. It was a flowery turn of phrase to describe something that's pretty disgusting and ugly. That
Huh.
place has got to stink down there. There's no ventilation.
It was cool though, because you got to see, the anatomists working on bodies, and one of them, they had this magnified mirror that was almost like acting like what we would see as a television screen. So it was showing what they were actually working on. So that was really cool to see that. Because this, the Victorian era, that there was a lot of advances in technology. It's like to me, it's analogous in a way to today. We have a lot of advances in tech, more of digital type, but theirs was more industrial but and scientific. But anyway, I digress, and I'm not prepared to have that discussion, so I should move on. So we learn that Victor Frankenstein, he likes electricity, specifically galvanism, and this is when electricity is produced as a result of a chemical reaction, and it's what contracts our muscles. And if you've ever had metal fillings and you chewed on a piece of aluminum foil, you just had galvanism happen in your mouth.
Why would you ever chew on a piece of aluminum foil?
Well, I think there was, if you had it on a piece of candy, wrapped around a piece of candy, and did it on accident or something like
Oh,
that,
okay.
it hurts if you
Oof. God, I'm
that's
just like getting
galvanism.
like chills thinking about that. But yeah, he asks he's kind of like looking around at everybody, and then he notices that Ethan is an American, and he's like, "Oh, you're an American." He's like, "Yeah, you're pretty clever." Did you tell by my accent? And then that's when he starts asking him about electricity and galvanization. He's like,
He
"Are you
just assumes
familiar?"
he would know.
He's like, "Are you familiar with the principles?" He's like, "Yeah, sure, right."
I had said to you that I thought this scene was a little heavy-handed, like they were telegraphing pretty heavily that this is Frankenstein, but you didn't think so because you didn't.
I didn't get that he was Frankenstein until the last scene, not when he
Right.
says he's Frankenstein, about like 3 or 4 minutes before that, when I first saw the body on ice.
And I think that just reflects what we knew going in. I knew there was going to be like certain characters coming from stories of like Victorian era, and you did not. So
Right,
I think
right.
that's why. So anyway, he's resistant to Mr. Murray and his request, even when money is offered. But Miss Ives knows how to intrigue him. She uncovers the corpse that they brought with them, and Victor's curiosity supersedes any instinct of fear he may be feeling once he sees it. And we learn some things when he starts to inspect the body. We learn that these vampires or have skin that is like an exoskeleton. They have teeth that never wear, and they have hieroglyphics that are carved into a bony subdermal layer. I really don't know what that layer is, but that's what I'm calling it for now, because that's what it looked like. So with high relief.
I don't think he was scared at all. I think any fear that he may have felt, which I don't think he did at all anyway, was trumped by his need to discover.
Yeah,
He's a scientist of the highest order.
I agree. So after this enlightening moment with Victor, Ethan asks Mr. Murray and Miss Ives, "Who the fuck are you people?"
This is why I don't think he's a vampire. The fact that
Werewolf.
Or I'm sorry, werewolf. Yes, thank you. This is why I don't think Ethan's a werewolf, and this could be a little bit of a weak sauce explanation. But when they're killing all the platinum-haired women, he's kind of taken aback by that. He's like, "Jesus," And then at this point, he stops them and asks them, like, "Who the fuck are you guys, and what the fuck are you doing?" And if he was a werewolf, you'd think that he'd be at least rudimentarily acquainted with this side of the world.
Yes, I can see what you're saying, but now that you're saying that, you got me wondering, because maybe he is a werewolf, but he doesn't know it yet. But he knows there's been a curse.
Okay, I
So,
could buy that. Yeah.
yeah, so, because I was also thinking, I've noticed, and it's not like I have a whole lot of evidence to back this up. This is off the werewolf subject, but it's interesting to me that it's set in London, but then we have Ethan Chandler, who's an American, and it's just like with Farscape. Ben Browder was an American.
So you're saying an American werewolf in London?
No. Well, hey, there you go. There's more proof right there. But anyway, no, what I'm saying, it seems like Sometimes Americans are used as the everyman, like as the man that inserts you into this foreign world.
He's your point of view
Exactly.
because he has your cultural biases at
Right.
heart.
And it would be an interesting twist if he is a werewolf.
I kind of hope that he is. I'm just looking for the real hard evidence
It's an
so far.
American werewolf in London?
Yep.
See?
Yeah, that's what I
See?
said. That's the name of the
Okay.
movie.
All
Yeah,
right. See,
that's another great horror film.
well, you keep supporting me.
You're right, I do.
Yeah. Okay. So after he asks, "Who the fuck are you people?" he is instructed to meet them later so they can discuss this with him. If he is not a pussy, that is.
Yeah, like.
Well, she really doesn't say that. She's just more like, if you rather go and shoot clay pigeons and
Tell
act, tell
lies,
lies.
yeah.
Yeah. But he's not really a pussy. He's a werewolf.
She doesn't have the highest esteem for his current profession.
She doesn't. But she's also like, knows he doesn't. You know,
Which is more important,
she's working on him.
yeah.
Like, that's her task, just like Sir Malcolm Murray's task is Victor Frankenstein, because we have parallel scenes there. It's interesting. It's like they were both like given tasks
Yeah, they've got their
almost.
own recruiting assignments.
Yeah, it's weird. It's not weird. It's interesting. But anyway, the event that took place at the opening scene of this episode, we're now back at that, and the remains at the crime scene are now being photographed, and we've got the reactions of the photographer, and thought it was really cool that they showed that camera, because that was also brought about in the Victorian era, and but it was very disgusting looking scene.
Oh yeah, all the body parts just laid around everywhere.
Very graphic.
Oof.
So what the hell did that?
Yeah.
I mean, that's not like vampire style.
No, not at all.
Is it werewolf?
I suppose it could be, but I mean.
Is it something in a rage? I mean, it doesn't look like it did anything other than like just tear him to pieces.
Yeah, there was no goal to this. I mean, it didn't even look, it could have fed, I guess, if it was going to eat some of the flesh, but I mean, there was a lot of it left over.
Yeah, I don't think it did.
Why would you tear apart a carcass like that if you're going to eat it? Why don't you just grab a leg and start going to town?
I don't know, but that's okay, we're moving on now. So Ethan arrives at Mr. Murray's. He is first met with the house servant, who seems to be much more than he presents himself to be. And his name is Sembene, and he is played by an actor named Danny Sapani. Danny Sapani? I think it's probably Danny Sapani.
He
So
has some interesting tattoos or markings on his cheeks, on his
I'm
cheekbones.
wondering if Sir Malcolm Murray met him in Africa.
That's probably a fair guess, since this is London in the Victorian era.
Yes.
There's.
A lot of excellent. Well, Dr. Livingstone was a famous person during the Victorian era, and that's who, not only, I guess, is Sir Malcolm Murray a Van Helsing, but he's also a Dr. Livingstone. So, Miss Ives is to meet with Ethan, and he finally learns her name. And she asks if he wants an explanation for last night, and this is where he says that he should speak with Mr. Murray. And it took me six episodes to get why he said that. Because at first I thought he was just brushing her off because
Six
she's a
watches of the
woman.
episode.
I know. Yeah.
Why?
I think it's because she has been so vague with her explanations up to that point. He's just like, no, I'm going to speak to Mr. Murray now. Because she just like answers him with questions. Does it matter?
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, he's not getting a lot of answers out of her at all.
So, but then she says she can speak for Mr. Murray or Sir Malcolm Murray. And she explains what the demi-monde is. It's a place within the shadows, a place rarely seen but deeply felt. She tells Ethan they were in the demi-monde last night, where unfortunate souls are cursed to live always. Miss Ives is attempting to solicit Ethan's further aid in any of their demi-monde adventures. Adventures makes it sound so lively. He asks her what her part is in all this, and she says her part is her own.
She is full of secrets.
Yes. And at this point, he is unwilling to work with them. And she tells him if he should ever find himself in the demi-monde and seeks to escape it, he knows where to reach them. But before he leaves, she wants him to pick a card. And she smiles enigmatically when she turns it over and sees it is the lover's card. And whoever conceptualized that image is brilliant, I think, with the.
A scorpion on the lips.
Yes. Yes. And that is our image for our podcast.
The demi-monde.
So here are some werewolf illusions. and I will give you them here. Miss Ives says to Ethan, if he finds himself to be unwise and looking for occupation, they could use a man of his skills, his kind of man. And then he asks, what kind of man is that? And she says, one of great violence and hidden depths. She tells him that he plays his role well, but it is not who he is. And then he asks her what she seeks to escape. And she says, perhaps the same thing as him. We all have our curses, don't we? And werewolf is usually what? A curse.
Yeah. And mm-hmm. he kind of does the squinty eyed thing when she says that.
He looks almost like he's like discovered, like threatened. Like he's just, what, bitch? What'd you say to me?
But if that's the case, then he would have to know he's a werewolf.
So he may know of a curse.
Oh, okay.
But he maybe doesn't know the result. Because don't werewolves not know what they do at night? Like, don't they not have a memory of it?
Yeah, that's part of some of the lore of werewolves, for sure, that they don't have a memory of it, but they know that they're doing it. Hmm. And that's why, you know that that's going to happen to you on every full moon. You just don't know what you're going to go do.
Okay. So, Miss Ives reports to Mr. Murray that Ethan has turned down the job. Mr. Murray seems unconcerned and sure that he will return. They have other matters to attend, and they have to attend an appointment amongst dead things. And they are to meet with an eccentric Egyptologist named Ferdinand Lyle, and I really wish I had looked up the actor's name because he's great. He's a great actor. Every time I watch this, I giggle.
He comes off like a gay Zidler.
Yeah, he does. He is like Zidler from Moulin Rouge.
Yeah, that's the impression that I took away. He does the role great. He's fun to watch on the screen. The camera loves him and everything. But that's how I would describe him.
Papyre.
Yeah, papyre.
So he is beside himself that Mr. Murray would pay him a visit, and he is not as impressed with Miss Ives, but he is polite to her.
And I'm sorry, if you're a straight male, you're going to be very impressed with Miss Ives.
Yes.
She cuts a striking figure.
And there are carrion beetles that Miss Ives takes an interest in, and she thinks are exotic at first, and then she learns that, well, they're just from Waverly and Suffolk. Anyway, so Mr. Lyle views these hieroglyphics and is soon a little disturbed and would rather reconvene later at another location. But first, Mr. Murray and Miss Ives must attend a fete his wife is throwing on the Friday next, I think is what he said. He ends their meeting by telling them these hieroglyphics came from the Egyptian Book of the Dead.
I got your damn book, like in the deal. Now send me back. Now, there was something I wanted to discuss inside of this scene. She goes over to the birdcage, and there's two birds in there, and they don't want to be around her. They just get all kinds. So, see, that just, it kind of goes back to what I was saying earlier. She's emanating some sort of something that makes, like, normal creatures kind of want to shrink back, and then creatures of the night, like, pause a little bit and go, what am I looking at here?
And maybe that's really the reason why Mr. Lyle doesn't really respond to her like you would expect. He almost kind of looks at her with some suspicion. Hmm. And he's amongst dead things all the time. I'm sure he's picked up some stuff, right? Possibly. Right.
Possibly. Yeah. I think he just has eyes for Mr. Murray.
Yeah. Yeah. That's probably it.
Wants to do the can.
So back at the crime scene that started this episode, the remains are being removed. The neighborhood women are discussing the victims. Ethan is in the crowd, and one of the women eyes him suspiciously. And also every time you see him, there are dogs barking in the background. Seriously, you don't hear the dog barking any other time, only when the camera's on him.
You're really pushing this. I hope it plays out.
And I do too. Otherwise, I'm annoying. People who have seen the whole series are just like, what an idiot. She eyes him suspiciously, and he sees this. He makes eye contact with her, and then he flees. And I already kind of discussed this a little bit, but is he worried that he may be guilty of this crime?
I hadn't thought of that.
So, because, you know, werewolves, like I said earlier, do not typically remember their activities the morning after. They probably wake up with things on them, you know, like, what the hell? Why do I have blood on me? Naked. I'm naked. Fur in my mouth. Mr. Murray has Sembene deliver a tux to Victor Frankenstein so they can meet at the Explorers Club in style. And we learn that Mr. Murray is an explorer, which we've already discussed. And he favors Africa. We learn about what both Victor and Mr. Murray desire to do with their lives. Mr. Murray wants to find a cure for a rare disease, and that would be vampirism, obviously. And Victor wants to pierce the tissue that separates life from death. And unlike Ethan, Victor is unafraid to accept his role among this group that's forming. And to drive this point home, you have a contrast where we see Ethan fearfully peering up at Miss Ives' window right after the scene cuts, and he flees when he sees Mr. Murray's arrival in his carriage.
Now, the scene with Murray and Frankenstein when they're talking about, I think Murray is, he's playing him to a certain extent. He's trying to get him to get agitated and say what he's really after. Don't you think? Because he's like, yeah, you know, he knows what kind of scientist Frankenstein is. And he's basically telling him, yeah, I've been to Africa and there's a mountain named after me and there's this or named after somebody in his family. He got to name it basically. And, you know, I discovered this stream and I did this and that and the other thing. And he knows this is going to set him off, you know, and he's like, cause you can, there's almost like a half smiling smirk on his face while he's saying this because he's looking for the reaction out of Victor and he gets it, you know, cause he goes on about, what does he say? That's solipsistic self-aggrandizement, you know, which is a mouthful, but it's just a fancy way of saying you're doing this to make yourselves feel better.
Well, he thinks like the pursuit of knowledge in of itself is pointless. And I feel like he has contempt for, you know, scientists of his age and, which I, you know, that's who he is. But, I think there is something, you know, amazing about, you know, the things he was being contemptible about, like the study of the variegations in a fern leaf and the coils of an adder. I think that is like by itself an awesome thing to really contemplate.
Yeah, I agree that knowledge for knowledge's sake is a worthy pursuit as well. But I think he's disdainful of people who do it as an affectation, as a rich person's dalliance, rather than using the time and the resources to actually do something that forwards science in general and, you know, make something of that knowledge. It's great. Okay, yeah, now we have this knowledge about the coils of an adder that you've studied for however long. What are you going to do with it? You know, does it become something that you index away in a book and be proud of at your next, you know, dinner?
I guess I didn't catch that's what he was saying.
That's like, just my interpretation of it.
Yeah.
You know, that's just what I think he's trying to get at. And I thought that this one of my... You know, as much horror stuff is in here and as much as I like horror, that's actually one of my favorite scenes in the show because just because of the wordplay alone, you know what I mean? It always makes me like have this immense respect for the actors. Like, how do you remember all that? And then how do you just, how many takes did that take?
He gets all fervent. It's like, calm down, dude.
Yeah. Relax.
He likes to pierce things.
At the closure of the scene, we get the impression that he's convinced Frankenstein enough.
Yeah, he you're right, because Sir Malcolm Murray, he is playing him in a way. He knows what buttons to push, and he ends up playing up to I don't know if it's his ego by saying, you know, because you're not afraid, you know, that's why I've selected you, and that cements the deal, I think, and that's something that you know, he's on board, because, you know, he's not only getting money to fill his poet-like bank account, but he's going to be able to see terrible wonders, and he's also being kind of rubbed, you know, nicely and told, you know, you're awesome because you're not afraid of things. And
everybody likes to have their ego stroked, you know, and you would think that somebody like Frankenstein, you know, would be above that, but nobody is, you know. Yeah. People like to hear that they're doing something special and different from everybody else and that they should be recognized and rewarded for that, or at least, in this case, patronized in their pursuit.
Sir Malcolm Murray is now back at home and he heads to bed. After undressing and adjusting his light switch, he discovers he also has to close a window. And
did you notice behind him there was that glass case and it didn't look like there was anything in there? It just looked like an empty glass case. And I don't know if that was just a stage prop that they had behind there or if that was meant to let us know that he leads even though he's rich and he has a lot of resources, he leads a very Spartan and utilitarian lifestyle because he's so focused and driven toward his goal.
I believe that about him. I mean, I didn't notice the glass case.
Yeah. It's just really dark glass and you're not supposed to be able to see anything behind it. I couldn't see anything behind it, though.
So... there's a storm outside and it's messing with the lights, and so he has to get up and adjust the light switch, and then when he walks back toward his bed, we see there's someone standing there, and it turns out it's his daughter, Mina, some specter of her, or it's actually her. He's convinced it's her later. And she's at first afraid, and then she turns frightfully menacing before she vanishes.
Her eyes are just completely red.
Yeah, she looks vampiric. She looks like the ladies that were down in the vampire's nest. So Sir Malcolm and Miss Ives discuss this visitation afterwards,
He's
and
shaking. Well, he's got his drink in his hand a little bit.
yeah, I would be shaken too. And Miss
Well,
Ives,
he's shaken, not stirred.
oh my God.
Little, I'm not a 007 fan, but I thought I'd throw that in for anybody who is.
So Miss Ives, she's standing at the fireplace, and the image of her standing at the fireplace actually reminds me of a John Williams Waterhouse painting. And I wanted to point that out because not only is he one of my favorite artists, but he was also a Victorian painter. So I don't know if that's an accident.
I feel immersed at this point because I'm reading The Anubis Gates by Tim Powers, and it's set in like 1810. Yeah, I'm just kind of like in this era. I can't get away from it.
Why would you want to?
I don't know, sanitation, running water, internet,
Justice.
cars, air conditioning. Anyway.
So anyway, we learn that Mina's current condition or situation is somehow linked to something that Miss Ives feels responsible for.
But Murray also takes part in that. He takes some of the responsibility on his shoulders as well, and he says our guilt. He refers to it as our
And
guilt.
I think they had sex, and I think Mina saw it, and she got upset because it's not her mommy he was having sex with, and she ran off with a vampire boyfriend.
Wow. I don't know if I can go there with you. There might be something to that, but yeah, we'll see if this bears out. That's a the werewolf one you had a little bit of evidence for, but I mean, just them having, I mean, where's the mother
I
anyway?
know there's not any real sexual tension between them, I understand, but
Yeah.
I'm just throwing it out there. We'll
It's not
see. It
bad.
might
It
stick.
it's not a it's not a bad one for just throwing something at a wall to see what sticks, but
Yeah.
I don't know if I can agree with you on that. We'll have to see. But we do get the impression, not implicitly, explicitly, that there is a secret shared between the two of them and something has happened.
She
And
called it her transgression.
her transgression, but like I said, he wants to take some of the shoulder for the blame as well.
So, Sir Malcolm tells of a thought he had during his daughter's visitation. He feels that the tables have turned and that he is now being hunted, essentially.
He talks about the lion that he was hunting in Africa and that look that turns you from predator to prey. I've seen our cats give us that look before. Scary.
So I think it's setting up the rest of the series that our protagonists are going to be under threat. So now Victor Frankenstein, he's walking in the rain towards his apartment. When he reaches his building, he gets the feeling that he is being watched. He turns behind him to look and sees nothing, but we saw that there was a figure that ducked away before he looked. And I don't know if this is actually gonna if there's gonna be any follow-up to this. It could be just a nod to readers of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, because Frankenstein, because of the guilt of his creation, he often felt like he was being followed.
I thought that there was something along these lines because he knows what he's about to go do or attempt. So it leads to a certain amount of anytime you have an undertaking like that and there's this
Moral
illicitness.
ambiguity.
Exactly. There's moral ambiguity in bucket loads in this. So he knows that there's a something bad about what he's doing, even though it's for a greater good, that being in the name of science. So there's probably a level of paranoia that he's carrying around with him, and that's how it manifests itself.
But if there is somebody following him, who,
Yeah.
Could it have anything to do with the fact that he messed around with the vampire body? Don't know. I doubt there would be. I mean, that's a really weak.
Yeah, because I mean, you've got three other characters that would need to be followed around as well.
Right. So next we have Miss Ives. She's praying intently again, and this time the results are terrifying. There's some poltergeist activity. There's the cross turning, and I forgot to mention that when Victor Frankenstein walks into his apartment, the panels on his door is shaped like an upside down cross. And I don't, you know, I just noticed it this last time I watched it, and I was like, that's interesting, because you would never actually see that on a door. And then it's almost like it was subtle foreshadowing of the next scene, because we have Miss Ives and her cross ends up being flipped, and you have all the spiders and some poltergeist activity.
What the symbology of Christianity in this scene is pretty striking to me, because at first you have one spider in the last scene and the cross stays upright, you know, and then in this scene, and you know that we've already determined, or at least we're putting it out there, that the spider is a representation of a malign spirit. And now the cross turns upside down and there's a whole host of spiders. And it reminds me of the story from the Bible where Jesus is doing exorcisms. And,
Legion.
yeah, and he comes up to a man and he says, "What's your name?" And he says, "My name is Legion, for we are many." And there's all those spiders, and it's just I don't know, I could be reaching on this one. Their threats are going to be myriad.
Yeah, they're gonna have. Well, yeah, there's something ripping up those bodies, and that's not vampires. Pretty sure of that.
Right.
It could be thralls, though. Would thralls do that?
I suppose, but
'Cause I mean, yeah, I don't know.
no, I don't think a thrall would do. It just seems like unthrall-like behavior.
Yeah.
They would probably have a thirst for blood, but the carnage is something altogether different.
So now, Victor Frankenstein, he has a secret lair that he can access via a false wardrobe, and he has the kinds of things you would expect to see in a lab of a man who studies electricity in bodies, such as electricity in a body. And
Oddly enough.
I know, that's so strange. And there is some trouble with, I guess, is a generator. And or whatever that contraption is, and because of a storm outside, and there's a surge of power, and then the power shuts out, and he lights a lantern only to discover the corpse is no longer on ice. And he searches the lab, and he finds his corpse animated and huddling against a far wall. The corpse approaches him and touches the anatomist's face, Mr. Frankenstein, and then touches his own. And Victor asks, "Can you hear?" And the dead giant smiles with joy, and Frankenstein introduces himself as Victor Frankenstein, and the monster is played by Roy Kinnear, by the way. And this is the end of the first episode. And this is where the first time I watch it, the only thing I really had issue with is how quickly a dead body was able to move after it was animated. You think I would think it would probably have some difficulty. But then I was able to rationalize it a little bit two different ways. You know, if you have a surge of power, you have all that extra electricity, you probably have cat-like reflexes, and you're up quickly. He was also sitting on some ice. That's my like second thing. He's just like,
Right
yow!
away when he comes back to life, "Oh, my ass is cold." Yeah, I would go with the electricity one, because I think it just jolted him like upright and out of that sitting position, and then he just walked right over to the wall and just kind of stood there.
So I don't really have too much just to add to. I've already speculated throughout my recap about the werewolf thing.
The way I'm looking at this show right now is it seems like there's a drawing together of people who are going to be at least somewhat ostensibly like-minded in their need or desire, I guess I'll say, to fight evil creatures, I guess, for lack of a better term, or to fight something,
Discoveries.
discoveries, to fight something specific, to find a cure for a disease, to find a way out of a curse. You know, they're all going to be brought together for, you know, their own purposes. Everybody's working their own angle in this. And then I think what's going to happen after the group has established itself, there's going to be a greater big bad that they're going to have to fight for their own survival, because they're going to draw attention to themselves.
Do you think that they're going to have a big bad, a different big bad every season?
That I don't know. I mean, I don't know if they're going to play the long game and kind of have one big, giant, big bad, and you know, you fight kind of like in a video game where you fight the mini bosses, you know what I mean, and then you get to Bowser at the end, or
Because we are kind of up against the master, like in Buffy's first season.
right. This guy's a little bit less verbose, thankfully.
Yeah, thankfully.
But
You got
yeah,
fruit punch mouth.
It's a good question. I mean, I don't know. It really depends on how they want to approach the writing of it. If they like how long of a game they're thinking of. If it's going to be a show that's going to go on for 5 or 6 seasons, which if they stay at this level of quality, I would hope so. But you know, if not, you know, they could do seasonal and then kind of cap it off at the end of each season, just in case you get canceled. So at the very least, you have, you know, and it's a shitty thing that shows have to think that way these days. You know, they can't just write the story that they want. They have to be kind of a little bit aware of the fact that they could be canceled and they don't want to leave any loose ends.
Well, you know, I hope that they don't have to be subjected to that. And I hope they have a little bit of freedom of creativity. It was interesting. This is off the subject of Penny Dreadful, but I was listening to an interview with the creator behind House of Cards and how Netflix doesn't allow them to see the numbers. So they just do their creative process without worrying about ratings. And apparently, a lot of people behind the creative process of television shows don't have that luxury. So they. You know, it shapes them, it warps them in a way, you know, their writing process.
Because at a certain point, you have to feel like you're writing what the audience, what you perceive the audience as wanting to
If the ratings are
consume.
low, you're probably gonna like change your approach based on
Yeah,
that.
that sucks. That sucks.
Because we know ratings does not make a show.
Oh, no. I mean, so many good shows have been canceled prematurely, but then you've
And
got,
so
you
many
know,
bad shows that have high ratings.
and they're still on after five, six, seven seasons,
Yeah.
and you're just like, really? You know, how does that. I mean, there's no accounting for taste, I guess, but
So, okay, I think that's it.
we'd love to to hear from anybody who's either just watching the show right now, like we are, or people who've already watched it. But if you've already watched it, just if you could just do us a favor in the tweets or in the you know, the email correspondence or however you choose to get in touch with us, if you do so, just don't be spoilery because we're kind of keeping ourselves fresh episode by episode, and we want to try to stick to that to keep our predictions pure and to keep the entertainment value of it up, you know.
Yeah, and that would be great just for our listeners too, who possibly are in the same boat. So you don't want to put any tweets on our Twitter page that are spoiling us or anybody else, just to be fair. And once again, you can reach us by going to www.noship.net. That's NOSHIP.net. And we also have a Twitter page at No Ship Network, or you also can go to our Facebook page, No Ship Network. And if you want to just go directly to our email, which you can access through our webpage, all those things you can access through our webpage, but our email address is noshipnetwork@gmail.com.
And if anybody just picked this podcast out of the blue because they're starting to watch Penny Dreadful and they wanted to have a cool podcast to listen to, we thank you for tuning in. And if you don't know who we are, you know, look around on our website. We did a two seasons of the show Vikings and five seasons of the show Spartacus.
It's four.
Four. Well, do you count Blood and Sand as, or I mean, Gods of the Arena as one?
It's technically 3.5 then.
Okay, three and a half. All right, so we did four seasons, I stand corrected, of Spartacus, and I guess it just felt like five because it felt like it took forever to get through them all. But
It
yeah, we've done other podcasts and they're worth checking out. So thank you for your interest.
Yes, and we'll be back with Vikings next March when it starts back up again. So,
Ah, season three.
yeah. All right. So, and we will be current with Penny Dreadful. We're going to go ahead and go through the first season of Penny Dreadful. And then when Penny Dreadful comes out, I think in May, I think is when it comes out. We are going to be current with that. So, all right. We will talk to you next week.
Have a good night.
I'm your host, Em.
I'm Steve.
All right. Bye. This was a No Ship Network podcast brought to you by Axolotl Tank Productions.